Ladies and gentlemen, it is my sincere pleasure to introduce you to Jared Bibler and his book, 2021 book, Iceland's Secret. The title is not overwrought. It is truly a secret. There's something that happened in Iceland that we don't know about. It is revealed in this fantastic book. Jared was in the thick of it. He joined the regulator after the wipeout. So the 2007 to 2009 global financial crisis, we all experienced it. It was miserable, but perhaps it was more miserable in Iceland than in any other country in the world. Actual Great Depression-like events took place. Bank accounts wiped out. Bank accounts closed down and unavailable. Capital controls that lasted until 2017. Bankruptcies left and right. Everyone declared bankruptcy. Everyone, you know, quote unquote, lost their house, lost their business, lost their car, jobs. It was a disaster. True financial disaster. Jared was there. Jared had come from the United States, came before the bust, joined the financial regulator investigating crimes that took place, and he writes about it in this book. But the key, and this is something Jared makes plain in the book and in the interview, it's not just about Iceland, it's about the financial system writ large, and it's not just about the global financial crisis, which is in the past. It's taking place right now. And ladies and gentlemen, the title, Iceland's Secret, which, by the way, check the show notes. You can purchase the book. You'll find where you can go and find the book, where you can buy it. There is a secret. We know only part of the story, what was carried in the headlines, but there's so much more. Stick around after the interview, and I'll share a bit of personal news.
Especially that the book is not especially popular in Iceland.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, mm-hmm. I do get really nice messages from Icelandic readers. You know, they reach out to me on social media. And they say, wow, you really did it. It's really good. But among Icelandic elites, there's been no recognition of this. It's all true, but it's not a particularly popular story. I think people wanted to just get past this, as you see in the book.
Well, let's talk about it. Okay, let me introduce myself. My name's Emil Kalinowski. This is Eurodollar University. I'm with Jared Bibler. But Jared, did I pronounce your last name correctly?
Yes, yep.
And we're going to be talking about your book, Jared, which came out in 2021. And it's called Iceland's Secret. And I loved it. I was on a flight to Iceland. I was reading it in Iceland. And it was fantastic. I highly recommend it to the audience for three reasons. One, the title is not an overwrought title. There really is a secret. Two-thirds of the way through the book, the story goes in a direction that I wasn't expecting, maybe because I'm naive, maybe.
I was naive too.
amazing. The second reason is because it's educational, informative book. So something happened in Iceland during the global financial crisis, perhaps continued. So it's important to know what happened there. We've heard bits and pieces of the story. And then the third reason is because it's a very personal story. I love that. And I'm going to commit a cardinal sin of interviewing authors, and that's to mention someone else's book other than yours.
Oh, that's
but it
fine.
Reminded me of Danielle DiMartino's book from a few years ago called Fed Up. She talked about her experience at the Federal Reserve, but it wasn't dry. What did I do in the morning? What spreadsheets did I calculate? What did the governors think and how do they act? She intertwined her own personal story, and you wanted to find out both what was happening on the inside as well as what was happening with her and her personal life. And that was the same thing with you. I really enjoyed it, and you grabbed our attention right from the beginning, Jared. I couldn't believe, tell people how you got to Iceland, the catastrophe that took place. And then at the beginning of your story, you hook us by telling us the kind of food you've been driven to eat? Do you remember what yes. you tell us? This I was from the yeah. Go ahead.
When Upton Sinclair wrote The Jungle, he said, I think he said something like, I was aiming for America's heart and I hit it in the stomach, because he was trying to change like labor policy. But he talks about how the sausage was made literally, and how like a little boy fell asleep. And anyway, it wasn't that bad. But every interviewer so far has asked me this question. So this really grabs people, this one detail, which is just one sentence in the book, right? But we, after the crisis, when the crisis hit, I'd been living in Iceland for 4 years at that point, and the life there is really nice. It's really, really wonderful. And so for me, it was just like my mom said, oh, you're already retired. It was like a permanent vacation. It was so nice. Work hours were not too bad. And like I say in the book, like we were talking about offline before, I was going swimming every day in these geothermal pools. I mean, it's a wonderful life. And then when the crisis came, suddenly things just snapped. And, you know, the supermarket shelves were going bare. The Gordon Brown regime in Britain declared Iceland as a terrorist state in order to freeze payments. I mean, things really got bad. And we were trying, my partner and I were trying to economize, because we didn't have the incomes that we'd had and so on. And I went to the farmer's market, which is called Kolaportið. It's also a flea market downtown Reykjavik. And I was just looking like, oh, what can I buy? And I found this beautiful package of like sausage. It's quite big and it was quite cheap. It was like, I don't know, it was like $4 or something for this big. It was like a lot of sausage. And I was like, oh, this is something we can try. So I brought that home. And she said, oh, you got this. This is like called hrossabjúgr, which means like horse sausage. And it's like made from horses. And it's not very good. You know, it's very smoky and there's huge pieces of fat, and basically you boil it. You boil it in a pot and you make some like mashed potatoes and you eat that. But it was kind of like, it was the marker that we had like, I felt like we had hit the bottom of the barrel when that happened.
Yeah. Globules of fat.
Yeah, they're pretty
big.
That's
how you described it. We're coming out of this.
Probably bigger than the end of your thumb, you know?
Oh.
Well, maybe you'd like it. You should try it next time.
I love sausage, yeah.
Yeah.
I wonder if anyone's going to cut that out and put that on a drop out of context on social media. But I love sausage. But
right.
Yes, when I read that, it turned my stomach. Tell people, you worked in finance in the United States.
Yeah.
You had expertise in software, maybe back office.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Management of financial systems.
Yeah.
You fell in love with Iceland. You wanted to move there. Tell people just a little bit about your background in financial history. And then I think we're underplaying the depths of the crisis in Iceland, because everyone understands what happened in their country the GFC.
Right.
But
yeah.
Iceland, it was Great Depression style depression.
Yes, yes.
Bank wipeout, savings disappearing. So,
yeah, okay.
Tell us how you got there.
Sure. Well, I worked, after college, I worked for about 5 years in a small consulting firm in Boston. And we were building the back office for one of the biggest Wall Street banks and rolling it out globally. So I got to know all these crazy things about how Japanese stocks settle. And I did a lot of work actually on mortgage-backed securities in the run-up to that boom in the New York market. Even someone in that bank told me that mortgage backs were going to bring down the bank one day. I mean, he said that in like 2002, 2003 maybe. So, and I didn't believe him, but of course he was right. So that was my background, but it was quite intense. I mean, I was working maybe 12-hour days and weekends and everything for a few years to roll out that system. I got kind of burned out. And I stumbled into, on a rare vacation, I stumbled into a chance to work in Iceland, doing something similar, but for much, much smaller banks, much, much smaller economy. So I said, well, I'll just try this for a year. You know, the big bank in New York, they were happy to have me back anytime. So I thought, well, I'll just try this. I'll just go to Iceland for a year and see how it is and try to see a new society. And as I already said, I loved it there. And so I lived there a few years. But during that time, the Icelandic banks grew. They were doubling in size. Their balance sheets were doubling roughly every year for several years. They had been really sleepy. I mean, Iceland only has, at the time, it only had, I think, 285,000 people when I moved there, the whole country. So, I mean, that population needs banks, and especially they need banks to fund fishing, which is a huge, huge industry. And they need banks to fund agriculture and business. So there's kind of three banks, one almost for each of those sectors. But these banks were not very big. And the Icelandic currency was not exchangeable outside Iceland. So you could go there as a tourist, but they had very few tourists in those days. You go as a tourist, you could buy Icelandic krona, you know, but when you left in the airport, you could exchange it back. But you, if you forgot to do that, nobody knew what it was outside of the country. So a couple of changes were made in the early 2000s, which was privatizing the banks and freeing the currency so that it could be bought and sold everywhere, like a regular FX cross. So that led to a lot of interest in Iceland because Iceland had high yields, so it had high yielding bonds. And at that time, the Greenspan Fed had yields down at, you know, the overnight rate was down at like 1% or something, I think, after the dot-com crash. That was pre-GFC. That was the bubble that built the GFC. Anyway, so people wanted these Icelandic government bonds that would pay 8 or 10% or more. And so money was just flooding into the country. And these little banks that you never heard of were suddenly able to double. And if you double in size every year for 4 or 5 years, I mean, you take over the world, right? It's this exponential growth. They each grew to be the size roughly of Enron. So three Enrons. I know that's pretty old news now, but I still think Enron's very important. But when Enron collapsed, it was the seventh biggest company in the U.S. I think seventh biggest listed company in the U.S. It was a huge story. But Iceland has 1,000 times fewer people than the U.S. And we had three Enrons go bust in 1 week in early 2008. And when that happened, it was just catastrophic for us living there. I mean, personally, we ended up losing our house. We had an old car, so we didn't lose the car, but most people also lost their car. And in Iceland, there's not really good transportation system, so you need a car. It was just devastating. The inflation was through the roof because one of the pressure release valves for the country, for an economy like that, when you have financial trouble, is the currency. So the currency immediately dropped in value. It lost half of its value, and then it was just frozen. Nobody was even trading it. So when that happens, when your currency loses half of its value, everything you import is basically double the price. So you can imagine the inflation. Inflation was crazy. At the same time we had the high inflation, we also had a collapse in the job market. So unemployment went up by 500-600% in just like a month. And you know, and like I already said, you know, supermarket shelves are going bare. And a lot of us had our savings in money market funds because we were greedy like everybody else. Savings accounts paid like only, I don't know, these are rough numbers, let's say only 10, 11%. but the money market was paying like 15. So it was like, oh, well, I'll just get the 15. But what we didn't know was the money market was not really invested in anything too good. And so when everything collapsed, also our withdrawals from the money market funds were frozen. So that meant we had no access to our cash. I mean, I had a little bit of cash in my, in my like the equivalent of like a US checking account, my debit card account. I had maybe, I don't know, $1,000 or $2,000 worth in there. But that was it. And I had all my other savings in the money market fund because we wanted, foolishly, to buy a bigger house. I'm glad we didn't do that. But we had this cash, which was then frozen. And by the time we got it out in real terms, we had lost about 75% on the cash, just the cash. And if you were invested in the Icelandic stock market and the broad index, I think you lost 97% in 2008. So the market just disappeared, really. There wasn't a market after that.
Astounding. Absolute wipeout. And an inavailability of cash. Unbelievable. And personal bankruptcies. When I was in Iceland, I was talking to one of the people there that we met, and he told me how he lost two of his businesses. Everyone was declaring bankruptcy. One of the reasons why was because the mortgages were linked to inflation.
Oh yeah, that, right? Of
they
course.
Would reset variable adjustable mortgages.
They reset.
Well, go ahead, tell us.
So, I've actually never I've never delved into the mechanics of this because I was so disgusted. I should know it. But basically, what you have is you have an interest rate on the mortgage, like 5%. But on top of that, so you pay that. But whatever inflation, so whatever the CPI did, let's say, in the past month, that gets tacked on to your principal balance. So your principal's always going up. And when you have really crazy inflation like we had during the crisis year, then our principal balance went, I don't know, these are rough numbers, but imagine if you had a mortgage for, I don't know, $300,000, and then suddenly the principal balance was $500,000. And then the month...
And at the same time, you've lost your job.
Yeah.
And you don't have access to cash.
Right. And the
and
monthly
the cash you would have,
the
yeah,
monthly payment, they adjust as well to match that. That's the part that I don't fully understand, because there were different flavors of these. There's some where the monthly payment adjusted one way and some adjusted another way. But basically, you end up just screwed in the system. And by the way, I don't believe they've changed this since. So I think this is still running basically the same way. So
the part that you made clear in the book, which I didn't know at the time, was that Iceland, for much of the 20th century, was one of Europe's poorest countries. It had absolutely nothing. And it seemingly exploded into this financial giant. Was it international conditions, or people were conflating Iceland? Oh, look, it's just another Scandinavian country. Sweden, Norway,
right.
we trust them. We trust Denmark. Finland, right. We look askance at it. Okay, but maybe Iceland is like those other countries. And they've opened up their currency. The banks are growing. The stock market's growing.
Yep.
Of course, you tell us why those banks are growing. But okay, so why the surge into Iceland? Just a new opportunity within a bubblish economic context?
Well, there's two things here. So Iceland was founded, the first parliament in Iceland met in the year 930, not 1930, but 930. And Iceland has a very old tradition of quasi-representative government and freedom from a king and so on. So the country was settled starting in 874 and had a sort of a glory time called the Commonwealth for several hundred years around the year 1000. And so and Iceland wrote the first prose literature in the Western canon, which are the Icelandic sagas. So it's a very proud place. And then it had many, many hard centuries. But that pride is there, and it's ready to be activated. And so when things, this is my impression as an outsider, but now a naturalized Icelander as well. But when things were starting to go well, people said, this is it. We've been waiting for this for 1,000 years, and now we got what we deserve. So the population was very happy to see this economic boom. There wasn't much questioning of it. And I moved there in 2004, which was kind of right as it was starting to take off. And that's not entirely true. Some people were questioning it, but by and large, it was rah-rah. And like you kind of hinted, so the countries close to Iceland, the other Nordics, they kind of look at Iceland as the strange little brother, or the the cousin who moved to the Wild West or something like that. They are a little bit careful with Iceland. And so I don't believe any of the Nordic banks had any real exposure when Iceland crashed. But the people who Americans seem to romanticize Iceland now, especially with the tourist boom. But I think like the Germans, for example, and now I live in Switzerland, in German-speaking cultures, Iceland is the pure land of the North. It's, you know, even in Greek mythology, there was a tool, I think this is Greek, this Thule anyway, which is the furthest north land. It's kind of a mythical place. And, you know, you had Wagner writes the Ring Cycle. This is based on Nordic mythology, but this is really Icelandic mythology. It was Iceland who wrote down these, what we call Nordic myths. So there on the mainland of Europe, there was a lot of money ready to to go to Iceland. So a lot of German Landesbanks, these are the banks of the regions of Germany, they were exposed, for example. Because the impression in these countries is that Iceland is a very pure and civilized and wonderful place. I mean, which it is on a personal level. So on a human development level, it's arguably the most developed country in the world. But on an economic development level, it operates more like, to quote one of my best friends, who's Brazilian, Icelandic, and also American. He's got three passports. But he says, Iceland is the furthest north of the Latin American countries. Because economically, you have high inflation periods, you have high interest rates, you have a kind of an iffy currency. and, you know, imagine this. You have an economy that's built today on tourism, fishing, and some exports of aluminum, right? If you go to a German bank and you say, I'm from an island of 300, now it's 360,000, I think. I'm from an island of 360,000, you know, in the Caribbean, and these are our industries. You know, would you lend to us? They would say, no way. But if you come from Iceland and say this, people, oh, well, yeah, sure. You know, so there's a kind of a, I don't know, reverse racism or however you want to say that. But it benefits from its mythological status probably disproportionately. Yeah.
Well, I was there and I was witnessing it. It is romantic there. I would lend them money as well.
It is. It's lovely. The Vikings, I love it.
And plus there's some sort of threat in the background that they'll maybe come ashore and sack your village. Everyone's yes. tough there. All the women are yes. 6 feet tall and blonde. All the men are even taller. So yeah, maybe it's best to give them your money. One more question before we turn to kind of part two of the book, because you're going to become an investigator. You're going to become an investigator for the regulator, the Icelandic regulator. Incredible. What great fortune. And that's what gave you the opportunity to dive in face first into these books and find out what actually happened. But before I go there, I'm going to commit another cardinal sin, but hopefully this time you won't hold it against me as much. But I'm thinking of another book, this one of our mutual acquaintance, Russell Napier. Mm-hmm. You arrived in 2004, and it reminds me of the moment when Russell arrived in Southeast Asia in 95-96, and
That's
he
right.
makes the point that he arrives not when the party began, but already when people were a bit inebriated, and you walk into the room
That's right.
and you can see people are inebriated, and it's happening. It's a little bit fast here, but that's because he walked in sober. When you arrived in Iceland, did you arrive sober? Did you look around and think to yourself, wait a minute, this mm-hmm. is a little bit, there's been a few too many drinks here, and the people don't realize that they've had too many financial drinks?
That's really cool that you made this parallel with Russell's book. I hadn't seen that. I've read his book too. I hadn't thought of that, but it's kind of true, because I was coming out of, you know, I had been through the dot-com bust in the U.S., and I was reading the book, one of my favorite books, to drop another favorite author, but Bethany McLean, she wrote The Smartest Guys in the Room about Enron, mm-hmm. which is just, I love this book. And I was reading that in the early days in Iceland, because the book had just come out. And I'm looking all around me, and I'm seeing kind of the Enron story, but like on a national scale. I couldn't figure out where the money was coming from to do, like there was a huge real estate boom in Iceland. And by the end of the boom years, there were more Range Rovers sold in Iceland than in all the other Nordic countries put together, which have much, 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 much bigger populations. But even in the early days, I was living in Vesturbær, which is the west end of Reykjavik, and that's on the approach path to the Reykjavik city airport. So not where you flew in, but there's a smaller airport, but that's also the private jet airport because it's right next to the city center. So I would see just private jet after private jet, and in what's effectively like a New England fishing village. I mean, you're just in a really small little town, cute, beautiful city, miniature city, but seeing like a few private jets in an hour coming into the airport was just really weird. And I asked my friends, at work, like, why are there so many private jets? And they said, but what? I mean, you're from America. Like, you must have. I was like, I've never seen this. You know, like, they said, yeah, but you're from Boston. I said, yeah, but I've maybe seen a private jet like taxiing at Logan Airport or something, but I never just see them every day coming into a much smaller place. So yeah, there were signs, and the other sign was just the stock market. It was going up 50 or 60% a year in those years. And so people didn't even want to talk about an investment that went up 20%.
We all thought it was normal back then, right? The 1990s had just finished. Stock markets were supposed to go up 20 to 30%. And if you're in Iceland, it's a little riskier. 50% seems right. Normal. Sure, we had a little downturn.
Right.
But now we're back to that boom time again, or not even boom time. It's as it should be. So it was easy to explain away.
Yeah.
Okay. All of a sudden, miracle, you get a job.
It was a miracle.
At the financial regulator.
Yeah.
And please tell people what was happening there. But what I remember was that one day you were asked to peek under the corner of this rug and see if there was anything there. Not literally, but you know, there's right. Something underneath that was swept underneath the rug. Can you take a peek under this corner? And eventually, as the story goes, you keep lifting the rug higher and higher, further and further back into time.
I like this.
And you're astounded. You're lifting the whole rug above your head. The lights went out while we're recording. It's so early. Go ahead and tell the people what you were asked to do. Mm-hmm. And you started unraveling the crime that took place. Mm.
Well, I want to say as a disclaimer, the book is, of course, everything is factual in the book, and it's my personal story, like you said. There may be many more angles to this story that we don't know, and I know that there are, actually. But this, to me, is one of the crimes that certainly underpins the boom years in Iceland. And I really want people to understand it, because I think it's, you know, the book is about Iceland, but it's also not about Iceland. And Iceland is kind of a petri dish where you could see things that are happening in bigger places more easily because it's a smaller society. But it still has all the traps. Still has a stock exchange. It still has banks. It still has all the things that other Western, that all countries have. But anyway, yeah, I got very lucky because the unemployment rate was through the roof, I had actually been working in one of those banks, and I quit. My last day was Friday, mm-hmm. October 3rd, and all the banks collapsed the following Monday, Tuesday, and Thursday, I think. So I just got out by the skin of my teeth.
And I'm sorry to interrupt, but for the audience, we're not going to be able to go over every detail in the book, of course, but there's a whole section about your experience at those banks and why you left, and it's so important.
Yeah,
we won't get to it here, but again, I urge the audience to get the book to find out.
Those are some good stories there, I think. The things that happened at the banks, I also put in the book because they're also things that happen at every bank. But it was my first time seeing them, but I think they happen in some form everywhere. But some of the stories are kind of crazy. Anyway, I leave that for the reader. So we had this dark winter, and in Iceland, the winter is very dark. We get about maybe 1 or 2 hours of a little bit of gray light each day, and then that's the day. Then you have another 22 hours of dark. But this dark winter, and then I got hired in the spring by the financial regulator called FME. They wanted one additional investigator, because they didn't really have an investigation team. They wanted one additional investigator to look at some of the new cases that were coming up out of the crisis. And they actually hired two of us, and I did, you know, I came in and it was just an empty desk and some binders and you know, like a Dell PC and some, you know, it was like a phone, and that was it. And they said, you know, well, good luck, go investigate the crisis. And I got lucky because early on, within a week or two, one of the lawyers came over from our team, and he said, "Hey, Jared, do you have some time?" And I was like, "Yeah, I mean, I have nothing but time." he said, "Could you look at this letter?" And it was a letter from the Icelandic Stock Exchange, and it was just a peek, like you say, a peek under the rug. But what they said was that they had noticed strange trading behavior in those 3 days before the banks collapsed in October 2008. So as the financial crisis was really ripping around the world, they noticed that the banks, there was one trader at each bank who basically bought almost 100% of the day's volume on the Icelandic exchange. It would be just one trader ID. And they just wanted to alert the regulator about this. And they sent that letter, I think, in January of 09. So it was already a few months later. And now I'm starting in April 09. So it's even six months after the crisis started. And this letter has just been sort of languishing. You know, they didn't have enough. I don't want to pick on these people. I mean, people were doing their best. But we had a regulator with about 35 staff total. That includes the secretaries, that includes, you know, everybody, the IT people, everybody. It was 35 people. And we had 3 collapsed Enrons to look into. And plus they had the daily business of regulating the insurance market, the investment funds, and all the other things that the regulator does. So there were many, many things like this letter that probably even never saw the light of day. But I kind of latched onto this because, like I said, I had done a lot of work in trading and settlement. And so this was something I knew that I knew about. I felt confident about it. And so I'll take a look at this. Yeah, sure. So I got the trading data from the exchange and for those 3 days. And it was crazy because it was like, is this all the trades? Because every trade, the buyer ID was one of 3 people at each bank. And they were only interested in the shares in their own bank, nothing else. And we were able to confirm pretty quickly that these were guys that were proprietary traders. So these were guys that were using the bank's money to buy the shares. But the volume was crazy. It was like every trade in those 3 days, this person was the buyer for every trade. And it was just such obvious market abuse. I was like, you know, well, I said, okay, well, we have a case here. We have 3 cases here. So let me just make sure that it's only these 3 days, you know, and then we can write this up and these will be my first cases. Wow, you know, cool. And there was a new special prosecutor's office. He was very keen to get these type of things. And the Icelandic public, I didn't mention this yet, but the public was livid for those 6 months, because when you lose your, you know, when you lose your even ability to buy food in some cases, people, and you're in a democracy, people go out on the streets. And people were really angry, demanding new elections for parliament and so on. And so there was a big public push in that first year to, like, you know, who's to blame for my lost life, my lost savings, my lost pension. So I felt that energy behind me, and I said, okay, I just want to see, make sure that it's just these 3 days. So I called the exchange and I asked for some more data. I wanted like 2 weeks of data just to see when the pattern began. And they sent me those 2 weeks, but it was the same pattern. So it wasn't just 3 days. It was at least half a month. But that made sense, because that was kind of like the fall of Lehman Brothers to that, you know. So I was like, okay. So I went, I said, okay, well, let's just go back another month. Go back maybe to the beginning of September 08. I think I don't remember exactly. Maybe it went into August, but I wanted to see just, okay, when did this start? Like, what was the trigger? Like, when did they start this pattern? Because I suspected it was maybe Lehman or something. And actually, when I went back a few months, it was the same pattern. When I went back, then I thought I'm being super bold here. And I went back 6 months. I was like, okay, April 08, October 08. Now I will find, how did this start? But actually, it was the same thing. A little bit less. I mean, some days they bought they didn't buy 100% of the market volume every day. That's pretty hard to get every trade, but there were many days. I think from the indictment, there were these are rough numbers. It was like 25 or 27 days in the last year where the biggest bank was over 75% of the volume on the exchange. But then if you go down to like a 50% threshold, there were like maybe, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but there were many, many more days. And so they were always active in the market for their own shares. And when I went back to try to find when this began, I ended up having to go back to 2004. And it was basically, coincidentally, it was right before I moved there that the behavior seemed to start. So for all the years I'd been living there, the banks had been kind of creating their own share price out of whole cloth. And as they grew, they crowded out everything else on the small stock exchange, so that by the end they were like 75% of the exchange market cap, and probably more.
The entire external face world facing message, financial message, the Icelandic Stock Exchange.
Yeah.
We were looking at it. We were seeing it rise.
Yes.
We thought, all right, well, something good must be happening. Yes. Markets are telling us that there is something good in the economy, the future, the economic outlook is bright.
Yeah.
But all the way back to 2004, it was the banks themselves buying their own shares, propping up their own shares, inflating everyone's pensions, right? Regular people, regular investments, convincing the outside world that things are going well. And of course, this was the executives at those banks, they were coming out very handsomely in this, right? Why were the banks doing this? Because from the top down, people were making money on this.
Yeah.
And it was, that's how they were enriching themselves. Is that accurate? That they were doing this they stole a bank. People got a hold of a bank, got into positions of power, and then they were using this bank to enrich themselves.
Yeah, and then,
am I overstating it?
I think that's about right. And people but the people who really benefited from this was not that many. You know, a lot of people in the banks were involved. By the end, I argue that this became the business of the banks, because when you spend in one financial quarter, when you spend several hundred million on your own shares, you have to then put those somewhere. That was actually the next part of the mystery. I don't know if we'll have time to get into that, but let's just say that it took over every department in the bank in some way. They needed, by the end of the quarter, just like with Enron, they needed to get their balance sheet squared up, because they couldn't be sitting there with, there were legal limits on how many of your own shares you could even hold, and they were well beyond those in many many quarters, but they needed to get that off the balance sheet by the 31st of March or by the 30th of June each year. And so there was always just like at Enron, there was a mad scramble at the end of the quarter to jigger the accounts. And they basically needed someone to buy the shares from them.
It's one of my favorite parts of the book, most educational parts.
So
who is buying this at the end of the day? So, and where is that money coming from?
Right.
Unbelievable.
So in the early days, it was like friends and family or local Icelandic client, you know, like fishing companies and stuff, even employees later. But the volumes that they needed to dump were huge, and they got bigger each quarter as the banks got in more and more trouble. So they would, in the end, they would create these clients. They would create companies offshore, especially in the British Virgin Islands. And that company,
Cayman Islands too.
I think there were some.
I have an alibi for each of those days.
I'm not sure there were. There must have been something in the Cayman, but I can't remember. Anyway, definitely BVI was big, and Seychelles, I think. Anyway, but they would create these companies, and then the company would do a huge trade, the kind of trade that were it legit, it would be in the FT. They'd do a press release, because it would be. some investor, you know, suddenly deciding to put $200 million into an Icelandic bank, buy their equity. That's a big deal, right? But never announced, of course. So, but where would a new company, where would a new company get $200 million to do this trade at all? And then the answer is that because it's a bank, they make loans. So
that is the key.
That's the key.
That is the key. When we talk about this to the audience, it's just hard to understand that banks create the incomprehensibly overwhelming majority of money that's in the world.
Yeah.
And they do it out of thin air. And yeah. This, your book, brought it home more than any other example I'm familiar with.
Oh, that's great.
Where did $200 million euros come from?
Right.
The bank wrote a loan to this brand new company. Well, it's a ledger balance.
Yep.
You now have $200 million and you use that $200 million to buy our shares.
Yep.
And it just came out of thin air. And what a bonus, we get to put this loan down as an asset in our books. Yeah. Everyone is happy.
Everyone.
Miracle.
Everybody wins.
Incredible.
Incredible. Yep. And so, I mean, they really innovated this. I think it's pretty fascinating. But, you know, a few years of that, because then, of course, those loans are not good loans, right?
No.
I mean, that in order to pay back that loan, that company's going to need to sell the shares. And the shares are going to crash if someone puts that many of them on the market. So that they had to keep that under the rug. But this is, I think, the reason for the fast growth. If you can double your size every year, you can outgrow the bad loans you made the year before. I mean, this is kind of a Ponzi around loans, right? So they were doing this even as far back as 2004. The quality of the loan book is getting worse and worse. There's a famous WikiLeaks document from the early days of WikiLeaks, which is the Kuiping Bank loan book from the summer of 2008. You can still see it on there. And you can just flip through those. It's a slide deck. You can flip through these slides and you can see that it's a lot of loans against their own shares to companies that you've never heard of. And this is always misreported, even by academics, even in the press, as that the Icelandic bank's shareholders took a lot of loans. But is it the wrong way around, I think? You want to take a pause? I think. You want to take a pause?
I can't afford to pay for the We're not on a volcano where the energy is free. We're not on a volcano where the energy is free.
So I think that, well, you might want to edit this part a little because I stopped when you went in the dark.
Okay. Sure. Go ahead.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I think that gets it the wrong way around. When people say, "Oh, the red flag was that the owners of the banks were taking out too many loans," it's like, no, they created those owners out of thin air and gave them loans to be owners, to hide the daily manipulation of the shares that they were doing on the market. And that's the part I want people to understand, or one of the parts I want people, yeah.
Yeah, in the last third of the book, the first two thirds, I suppose, is a story, narrative, excitement. There's a fabulous story of you saving some poor teenage girl from being grounded in the deep
in
north
the West
because
fjords,
there's a whiteout storm. So there's delightful narrative stories all throughout there. Yeah. And the last third, it's more ABC, what happened, how was it being done? Very informative. And so your investigations continued and there's some jarring moments. One of the most jarring for me was when you arrive at the bank because the bank is one of the banks is stonewall. I guess they all were, but the one I remember was they were stonewalling you and they'll say, yeah, sure, we'll respond to you. And it's been a couple of weeks. So you arrive there because you're an American and you just show up, whereas an Icelandic person would just continue sending voicemails or emails. You show up there. And I found it so jarring that you arrive at this bank that is part of the reason why there's another Great Depression taking place in this country, a wipeout of savings, capital controls, mm-hmm. bankruptcies. Mm-hmm. And you wouldn't be able to tell it no. when you walked into that bank. It no. looked glorious. They yeah. had waterfalls coming down yeah. the walls, yeah. marble, everything. And that was the first hint of what we would, the secret of what was coming as foreshadowing. You go on a raid too,
yeah.
With a police officer that I'm imagining out of some crime oh, detective
he's
novel.
He's fantastic, that guy. Yeah, he is out of a novel.
He's yeah. drinking only coffee and bourbon. That's the only thing he's that powers him. No food needed. So fantastic stuff. And the momentum's building. You're doing good work. You're gathering data. You're identifying these crimes. And the momentum is gathering. You're getting more staff.
Yeah. Yeah, we've...
It's building. Yeah. You're only discovering just the big pieces. There's still a lot more to be investigated.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Do you want to tell people the twist or not? Should we? Because I got more questions.
Oh, we can...
Then the people... Yeah, go ahead. What do you want to... Where do you want
to
go?
Let them discover the twist. We can go to the other questions, maybe.
Okay. That's good, because we're told Iceland led the way. People went to jail, whereas in America and Britain, nobody went to jail. Everything's yeah. fine. Yeah. Iceland did it right. I have questions. I wrote down questions here about the central bank. I had a big question mark. That 500 million, was it euros?
Euros.
Or dollars?
Yeah.
How did that get approved? So many questions.
Yeah, yeah.
So many questions.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll leave it at that. I do recommend, ladies and gentlemen, that you get the book to find out more.
The issue with that central bank 500 million has never been satisfactorily explained to today. Yeah.
Yes.
Yep.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. I was looking at the, and so, okay, so now you're in Switzerland, you're at a new regulator, is that right?
No, I have my own.
Pursuing the work that.
I have my own consulting firm, so.
Okay, so, when we finish the interview, you have to let everyone know, okay?
Okay.
What it is that you do, you have to advertise that. Let's go back to Iceland again. Earlier you mentioned a real estate boom in the early 2000s. Across the street from you in Basel, the Bank for International Settlements, they put out early warning indicators for private credit.
Okay.
And they have 5 different measures. Too much credit too fast, or debt servicing ratios that are too high. They did this by nations, cross-border claims of foreign banks lending into a country relative to GDP, household debt servicing ratios, and then they have a real residential property index, and they say if your real estate is booming, that's okay as long as you're on your national trend. So if your trend is crazy, if that's what you're used to,
yeah,
that's okay. You're still crazy, that's okay. Like Canada and Australia, for example.
Right.
If that's what you're used to. But if you accelerate even off your trend, well, then they say, well, there's a good chance. In fact, they put that chance at 50% of a crisis, systemic banking crisis within the next 3 years. Mm-hmm. In the last quarter, a number of countries, last available quarter, which was June 2022, a number of countries tripped that indicator. Canada for the first time, Australia for the first time.
Interesting.
Booming past their bananas crazy trend.
Yeah.
Well above it. Mm-hmm. And now it's a warning, hey, you've got too much credit coursing through your system. Mm-hmm. And guess which country I saw on there also tripping it for the for the first time in
probably
the history of the data history. They only started collecting it in 2008, if I remember correctly.
Okay. Right.
But now they've tripped it again. Iceland in the first quarter of 2022. I know we're not going to have the same thing happen that we've had it before, but we talked about earlier how it was the pride of the people of Iceland. They didn't look at this as their problem. it wasn't caused by Iceland. It was the global financial crisis. It was America's mortgage-backed securities that caused this.
Right.
When you were splitting the banks into a good bank and a bad bank, it wasn't good assets and bad assets. It was Icelandic assets, which are good.
Always good.
Because they're in Iceland.
Yes.
And bad assets, which are the foreigners, those dirty foreigners.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
So we're not going to have...
I got called...
Is it happening again?
I was going to say, I got...
Are we having a boom again?
I got called dinner there a few times. But anyway, because I think the same people in a lot of cases are still in the same positions, or their proteges are in the positions. And I think the reckoning for, Iceland got nice headlines because there were some prosecutions, and there should have been more, but there were some. And I think that was a sort of a balm. And the other thing is that the prosecutions, these cases are complicated. Even in the U.S., I think the average SEC case takes about 5 years. And by that point, the country was in a different place. The darkest years was probably 2 or 3 or 4 years after the crisis. But by about 2012, 13, 14, things were getting better. I guess the cases took a little longer. The first indictments were in 13. Some of the cases were, but you know, these guys, they're defense lawyers, they used every procedural trick in the book to try to keep, to try to delay and delay and delay. But the final verdicts from the, and then they appealed everything to the Icelandic Supreme Court. They appealed, as Iceland only had two levels of court. They had the district courts and the Supreme Court. And these guys appealed so much stuff that it necessitated, Iceland created a mid-level appeals court actually, just because of, so everything was going to the Supreme Court, all of these cases. And the Supreme Court almost universally found these people guilty. In many cases, it made the penalties harsher than what the district court had set.
I love that.
But
that was
still, the penalties
very
were not very extensive, as you saw. I mean, and it's the same in many countries. If you get a 5-year prison sentence for white collar crime, you probably don't, maybe you serve a year, maybe not even. And
I rarely serve out my sentence.
Right. I haven't even reported for mine. So.
And then there were several of these cases or instances were appealed even further to the European Court of Human Rights
yeah,
or something.
Yeah.
So even more appeals that were then
complicating
the whole mess forever.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Iceland's when we look at Iceland, we think it has recovered.
Yeah.
But has it? You made the point here that the country has been irrevocably changed, and you feel that it's not for the better, that it's the hollower.
I'm nostalgic for the Iceland that I moved to, and that's probably just my own attachment to that. But the tourist volumes, at least pre-COVID, and I think they're coming back to that now, maybe. But pre-COVID, Iceland had 10 tourists per year for every man, woman, and child in the country. 10 to 1. And that has changed the character of the of Reykjavik, which is our only kind of city. So I'm just nostalgic for the Reykjavik that I miss. Some of my Icelandic friends say, yeah, but look, we have so many more people here in the city now because of tourism that restaurants can be open longer. You know, there's more for us to do because of the tourists. But I went into a store in my last visit there on Laugavegur, which is the main street in Reykjavik. I went to a store. I said, "Góðan daginn," you know, good day. And I started asking the person something, and the guy didn't speak Icelandic because they even had to import workers for the stores from other European countries because to handle the tourist volumes, the country can't handle with existing population can't handle those volumes. So. Yeah, the country has, you know, when your currency loses half its value, it becomes attractive to tourists to come there. The currency has never recovered its value, its levels of the early 2000s. It's still stuck at those lower exchange rates versus the dollar and euro and stuff. So I think, yeah, the country was able to rebuild on the back of tourism. But my personal opinion is, for a place with a long history of democracy and a very well-educated population, it can do better than tourism as its main industry and should do better. But I don't live there anymore, so I can't, you know, I feel a little bit hypocritical about that. But I feel very sad about it.
Yes, yeah, so when I was there, I was trying to be my nicest, because I was reading your book and I was reading those sentiments and wanted to express my gratitude to the people I was there and mm-hmm. not seem like a burden right. to people there and not disrespecting the culture. So I did my best.
Yeah.
I did take off all my clothes before entering the pools and did wash myself thoroughly
well,
for
that's just,
the audience.
You got to do that.
Yeah, you've got to. Yeah. You've got to. Don't bother entering any of those pools without getting fully naked.
There's no chlorine.
Before you enter the pool.
Yeah, you got to
just shower.
You got to get clean, because there's no chlorine. It's just natural water. So, yeah.
Okay. There's a lot more in the book, but is there anything that we didn't cover that you wanted to bring to the audience's attention? If not, can you tell us what you're doing now, what you see about the, what you think about the future? Any final thoughts that you wanted to share?
Sure. I think some people misinterpret the book because they just see it as a tale about Iceland. So someone I went to MIT with, he wrote me a nice email and he said, hey, I really loved your book. It's a shame about those Icelanders. When will they get it together? And I wrote him back and I said, look, I never would write a book to pick on my adopted homeland. The book is a cautionary tale for me. And I think that the systems and the patterns that you see in there are also the story of our financial system, like writ large. And the conflicts of interest and the bad incentives for regulators, the fact that if you're a regulator in almost any country and someone comes to you with a $5 billion fraud, and you want to go after that, you're probably going to lose your job for that. Big crime. They don't even look for it in many cases. They go after smaller things. They fine and da-da-da. I mean, they do something in many cases. But when it comes to a huge scam on this level, which I'm convinced there are others running somewhere, they're not set up for that. So I think that's the message I would like people to take away. Is how does this apply to where I live? And yeah, now we have the noontime bells here in Bern. And as far as what I'm doing now, I have my own firm, Skatla. It's a Swiss company, and I've been doing consulting on investigations like this. But also, I've been doing a lot of work recently on sustainable finance. And actually, there is a connection there, because I think that's the next, that's going to be the next place. For, you know, and people are already talking about greenwashing, but this is the next place where you can do massive frauds, I think, because there's, in Europe anyway, there's so much demand for like sustainable investment products. People don't want to buy bad companies. They want to do good with their money and so on. And so the temptation there to just slap a green label on everything is so great. And so I think this is another brave new frontier of financial market scams potentially, but also if done right, it could be transformational for the world. And we need to transform the financial system to get a cleaner world. And this is also how I end Iceland's secret. How can we expect to have clean air when we don't have clean running financial markets, which we patently don't? So I would leave you with that message.
Yes, a little depressing, but
well,
it was informative, educational. Yeah, go ahead, Jared.
Well, I don't want to be depressing, I guess, because I see it as a problem that's easily solved. But it takes...
Human character, though, that's the problem.
Yeah,
human nature stands in the way.
Well, but human nature also stands in the way. So why do we have such a safe aviation system, but it's humans flying the plane? It's because we have the right procedures, we have the right checks. We take that seriously. When a plane crash happens, people go and investigate. Why did this happen? You know, they grounded the 737 MAX for like a year, right? And rightly so. But nothing like that happens in finance. Nothing. And
so optimistic then. We need, it's the people that need to demand the change, right? It's not that the leaders, it's not for us to look to the leaders who are likely intertwined with what is happening and enjoying the financial benefits of a loose and shadowy system. It's the people who need to be outraged.
People were
out. Will they be?
People were outraged in Iceland and came out on the streets all winter, in that dark winter. They were there all day from early in the morning until night outside the Parliament building, banging on pots and pans, lighting fires. I mean, it was a bit crazy, but there were always someone there. And that's the kind of energy that we needed. It could happen anywhere. But the negative part maybe is like, it's going to take an Iceland style collapse in the bigger countries before people wake up to how much the financial system affects them. People think it doesn't affect them, but it affects their ability to buy milk at the store. You know, it's intertwined with the payment system, and it's a part of daily life that is quite corrupt, but people are taking it for granted. That's kind of the message I want to get on.
It's cyclical in nature, right? Because we are exiting the laissez-faire era of the 80s, the Thatcher, Reagan, which itself was a reaction to the capital controls and financial repression that came in after the Second World War.
Right.
So it's a natural pendulum swing.
Yep.
We've reached the end of that laissez-faire economic system. And I'm sure, unfortunately, we're going to come into another crisis, a devastating crisis, that will create another pots and pans revolution, another Occupy Wall Street.
Right.
And this time the leaders will feel that it's in their electoral interest to pursue these cases and implement stringent regulations, but not new regulations, it's enforcement.
Yeah.
And that'll last for a generation, then it will start swinging the pendulum the other way, which is fine.
We're probably
humans.
Yeah, probably so. Yeah.
Jared, it was a real pleasure. I hope to see you in Switzerland one day and come and shake your hand, enjoy share a coffee together or something.
Would be lovely.
I love the book. Thank you for writing it. And I'm worried that one day you're going to have part two, another country, another something, maybe green secret, something like that, ESG secret.
Yeah, maybe. Thanks very much. It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.